Well, the situation, if it hadn't already been serious and tragic enough in Japan, is getting worse by the hour. This is Coast to Coast AM, and this is the night in which we spring forward with your clocks. Just keep that in mind. We're going to spring forward right into the show coming up this hour because coming up next hour on Coast to Coast, we're going to talk to Dr. Andrew Newberg about a very fascinating study that's been conducted over the years on the effect of prayer and meditation on the brain. Breakthrough findings from a leading neuroscientist. Two gentlemen have been studying the effects of meditation, the effects of the belief in God on your brain patterns and your brain productivity. Neither of these gentlemen are particularly religious. Andrew Newberg is open to the idea of what God is, but his research partner, Mark Robert Waldman, not particularly. I mean, he would fall much more into the skeptical researcher role. However, that having been said, the book, How God Changes Your Brain, coming up next hour, will explore some fascinating new material here on Coast to Coast. And it might come in very handy, as that may be all that some people have left in Japan at this hour to get them through. We have, of course, ample testimony of the devastation of the earthquake in Japan and then the ensuing tsunami. But now we have had it confirmed as recent as just a few minutes ago. I'll read this from the FoxNews.com website. Japanese government official says partial meltdown likely underway at least one nuclear power plant. You may have seen the video of that power plant exploding, the outer shell of this nuclear containment building just exploding. There was already a high level of radiation in the air. It's said that the people in the area have been exposed to the amount of radiation that one might get in 1 year, and they got it in 1 day. They're handing out pills that they hope will help brace the thyroid for an onslaught of radiation poisoning in the air. They're not saying that the meltdown is happening because they can't know. They can't get close to it. It's much like Chernobyl. A little bit later on this hour, we'll talk with James Childs about that. He has studied Chernobyl and he studies disasters. But before we go there, we thought we'd take a quick look at the weather patterns over that part of Japan and see what it might be like if there is a continued meltdown, if, in fact, the worst-case scenario is underway. And again, Japanese nuclear officials said on what is already Sunday in Japan, we must assume that a meltdown is already happening. Their Hail Mary of flooding the containment area with seawater has failed. So what will that mean for us and when? What might that mean, not just in terms of reaching out and helping the Japanese, but also in having to be protective of our own shores, of our own air? What will be the weather patterns when and if this meltdown continues to occur and hits the atmosphere and hits the environment? It's coming our way, and meteorologist Patrick Hammer will tell us more about that coming up next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, as I was just saying, it has gotten dire in Japan, and even while the world will be sleeping tonight, we're going to be hearing the latest here on Coast to Coast as the nuclear disaster gets worse. It's not going to get better. It can only get worse. To what degree it gets worse, we don't know yet. We do know that radiation is leaking out, and Japanese officials just can't say how much or when it will hit the atmosphere. But we do know that they have ordered the distribution of potassium iodine to people who may have been exposed to the area immediately around this disintegrating nuclear power station in Japan, because it helps block the intake of radioactive material in the thyroid. We know it's going up to some degree into the atmosphere. Just how far and how long, that we don't know. Five Eyewitness News is the local ABC affiliate in the Twin Cities. Patrick Hammer is my friend who is a meteorologist there. Good evening, Patrick.
Good evening.
All right. Now, we should also mention just that you have spent some time with the Olympic ski team and that you were a consulting meteorologist for them. So you know a little bit about following these international patterns. And it's one of the cool things about your resume. I asked you tonight to take a look at the charts for this nuclear power station in northern Japan and what might be coming our way. If it were to come our way, how would it get here? We don't know yet about the amounts, but what are you seeing already in this story that the rest of us don't?
Well, one of the things that is the first thing that jumps out at you when looking at weather patterns is how are they different on the other side of the globe? And with working at the with the U.S. ski team, you know, first of all, when you look at weather patterns in Japan, they're not terribly different from how they are here. Japan sits at a latitude roughly the same as North America. It's a little adjusted north. So the prevailing winds are jet stream level, at the jet stream level, rather, are, you know, west-east. When you look, though, at any kind of nuclear leakage, obviously the leakage goes from the bottom to the top, but then, of course, it can also go to the bottom. If you think of the movie The China Syndrome, the leakage can go down. But in terms of atmospheric dispersion, the leakage will go up, but it takes a while to get to the jet stream level, which is the winds that would be necessary to take that kind of polluted air to North America. In Chernobyl, the reaction or the reactor and its and the explosion there took the air, I call it polluted air because that's just the best way to think of it.
Why not?
It actually, you know, if you look at where Chernobyl is, it's in the western part of, western part of the Soviet Union then, but the western part of Russia now.
Right.
And actually took that air west. The most affected areas were Europe and Scandinavia, and actually some of that air actually made it over towards northern Canada.
Now, is that because of the rotation of the Earth that the polluted air, as we could just call it, that came up from Chernobyl, went up, and then the Earth rotated underneath it as it was coming back down again?
That is a very good way to look at it, because that kind of, you know, it's hard to get that air that high in the atmosphere to travel the direction that you would assume it to go, which would be from west to east. You know, to get to that elevation, that air needs to rise.
So in this case, it might be the same thing in Japan, where the air would go up, the polluted air would go up, the Earth would rotate under, and stay there, and then it would end up landing, ironically, then perhaps in the eastern part of Russia.
Exactly. And when I was researching this a little bit, I kind of was thinking, okay, well, some of that air would go downwind and would continue off into Mongolia and then possibly Japan. But in fact, it was the opposite. It was to the west of Chernobyl. So in the scenario that we're facing now, the prevailing winds, if you were to look at Japan, the upper level winds are west-east, just like they are here, because we're in that portion of the Earth where the westerlies move weather systems along fairly rapidly.
Right.
Japan is just, if you were to, one of the things that I think is fascinating is how different Japan is meteorologically than it is from North America. I saw some live reports today of reporters who were standing with 10-foot snowbanks behind them. It's an incredibly snowy country. They have tremendous elevation changes and also enough cold air and moisture to bring lots of snow. I was there 4 years ago with the United States ski team in the northern island of Hokkaido, and I was in Sapporo. And the snow depths there are incredible. And it surprised me because it's not that far off sea level. But that doesn't matter when it comes to dispersion of nuclear material, because I don't believe it gets that high in the atmosphere. And
all right,
the prevailing winds generally are west to east. However, you can get a significant sea breeze. And if you're on the east shore, which is where these nuclear reactors are, you will get a sea breeze, which, of course, would be easterly.
All right.
Take it back over to Russia.
Let me jump in here and say again, we're talking with Patrick Hammer, who's a meteorologist for the ABC News affiliate in the Twin Cities and a friend of mine. So, Patrick, I asked you to take a look at these. That's already good news, then, if based on the Chernobyl patterns, the likelihood is that at least some of this polluted air, the initial burst of it, would end up going, maybe I say good news, but I mean, it wouldn't be necessarily heading toward us. It might be heading to a sparsely populated part of Russia.
Exactly.
That is good news, although there are some people who will be affected by it. It could be a lot worse. But let me ask you, because I also know that, you know, theoretically, if one let a helium balloon up in the air, or let up a dozens of balloons in the air, such as what happened in World War II, where the Japanese allowed bombs to float up on these balloons toward the western part of the United States, that eventually they did, in fact, get here. I mean, it took a long time, but they got up high enough and they did travel enough. So there's at least a model for this. If the meltdown continued, if they weren't able to contain it as relatively quickly as they did with Chernobyl, that if more and more and more of the stuff got up in the atmosphere, it could theoretically get high enough that it might come our way, or even enough of it might go in the air that the Earth would continue to rotate underneath it, and it might eventually have enough to sort of trail around the world. Is that possible?
That's a concern, because for instance, if you think of a volcanic activity in volcanic ash that gets into the atmosphere and it circumnavigates the entire globe over and over again.
Like what happened in Iceland.
Exactly. And interesting that you bring that up. Believe it or not, we're far more under threat of any kind of modification of our climate due to tropical eruptions versus northern latitude eruptions. Because for instance, after Pinatubo erupted, I believe in the early 90s, there was a climate cooling, and that's a tropical location. The exhaust from a volcano in the tropics covers the tropical oceans, which have far more heat energy available, and that's what possibly affect the climate far more than a northern latitude volcano. Having said that, for any kind of volcanic eruption to affect any kind of climate, it's got to get up in the atmosphere. It's got to get up there. And that's a long ways to go. And I am not sure that any kind of radioactive material could ever make it that high. And thus, it's the global circulation that would be the more efficient
likely
way
scenario
of transmitting it across the globe. And I think the other point to make here is that there's so much, at least with this story, that we don't know. We don't know what the meltdown scenario has actually occurred. How many reactors have actually,
Well, except that the Japanese officials say we have to operate under the assumption that a meltdown is occurring.
Correct.
So, I mean, I would imagine as officials are in this country, they are in Japan, they are as likely to give the best possible case scenario. And that if they're saying we have to operate under the assumption that a meltdown is occurring right now, then my assumption is if that's how they're couching it, then a meltdown is absolutely happening right now, and there may be a 10% chance that it's not happening, and they're stressing the possibility that it isn't, as officials tend to do, to try to avoid panic.
And it's certainly hard to believe that a meltdown is not occurring when many of us saw the video today of the physical plant
just
of the reactor exploding.
Yeah.
And granted, the actual reactor may have been stable at the time, but clearly there's an 8.9 earthquake in the scope of earthquakes and how they go is extremely rare.
Right.
And as we all know, extremely more powerful than the counterparts that we saw even recently in New Zealand and in Haiti.
We'll wrap it up here by saying this. I heard one Japanese official refer to it as the potential of having a China syndrome. And
right.
I thought, well, that's so interesting that that should become part of the lexicon, because China syndrome here is based on that old notion that if you drilled a hole down through the United States, you'd come up through China.
Exactly. And
so, but we know since they're next door to China, it's not the China syndrome. I was trying to think, what would be the, if you drove,
syndrome.
Well, is that what it is? What would be the exact opposite? I was trying to figure.
Exactly the opposite would be syndrome.
Is that what it is? I was trying to figure where would it go? Or would it come out through the Southern Atlantic? It's right now, let's just say we're still in that phase when we're waiting for the next word to come. Thank you, Patrick Hammer, for giving us those thoughts on the weather patterns after Chernobyl. And hopefully this means that whatever radioactive material gets released, it will go to a very sparsely populated part of Asia. And that will hopefully be the end of it. But if not, you know that we'll be hearing from you again. And thank you, Patrick, so much for giving us your time this weekend. Let's bring in James Childs, who's an author. Inviting Disaster is Jim's book that keeps putting him at the center point of disasters like this, because he studies just exactly what goes wrong. And I asked him to take a look at this situation, too. Good evening, Jim. I understand we're getting you up. He's not there yet? Okay. I saw him up on the screen. I know we were getting him on vacation, and he had made provisions to grab our call here coming up in just a second. But we're going to ask him about what happened in Chernobyl, what went wrong and what went right, and what do we know about what's happening in Japan as we speak. As I said, I was reading here from a couple of different news websites, and everybody is kind of saying the same thing, it's beyond the control right now of any human being. There is nothing that human beings can do. We were talking about the translation of lexicon. I heard at least they were quoted as saying, whether he said this a different way in Japanese and it was just reported using the English expression, I heard a Japanese official refer to the flooding of the area around the overheated core of this damaged nuclear power station in Japan as a Hail Mary pass. And I thought, wow, would they say Hail Mary pass in Japanese, or did they just translate a similar expression from Japanese into English? Well, up to 160 people have been directly exposed to radiation. That number may go higher. Thousands have been evacuated. Somewhere in the area of 150,000 people have been evacuated, and that officials are admitting that the radiation levels are very likely to rise above any acceptable limits within the next few hours to days. And it is an unbearable situation on top of an unbearable situation in Japan. If you are likely to support International Red Cross, this would be a time, because they're going to need it. Literally hundreds of thousands of people are starving as we speak. They have no water. They have no food. Millions of people remain without power. And even in Tokyo, where things are better, there are still aftershocks that are still being felt, and still the fear that at any minute there could be another earthquake. Aftershocks are being felt around the Ring of Fire. And when we look at this situation, we hear the word Chernobyl-like disaster, you know, on top of the references to the tsunami, the Christmas Day tsunami of many years ago, or perhaps even like the flooding, that bowl-like flooding that happened after Katrina. On top of all of that, you've got a Chernobyl-like disaster that's looming. So we'll find out a little bit more about Chernobyl coming up in just a second and how that might inform us about what's happening in Japan. Even as officials stand over this hulking, melting mess and try to guess at what's going on outside their view. How God changes your brain, could that help tonight? Well, this is a breakthrough research from a neuroscientist. I saw the movie Limitless the other day, and we were supposed to have the director from Limitless on in this first hour, but they had to change that. But it was still a very interesting movie, and I will talk about that with the this neuroscientist coming up. The possibility, what would our lives be like if we could use 100% of our brains? It may not be possible, but it may not be anything we'd want to do either. We'll talk about that coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Bonnet. We will take some open line calls between now and the top of the hour on Coast to Coast before we get to how God changes your brain. We're reminded that 1-800-RED-CROSS is the number that you can call to make a donation if you'd like to help out with their relief efforts. RedCross.org is the website. And tonight, if you haven't been on iTunes, you may have missed this story. iTunes is accepting donations for the Red Cross. And they're not taking a piece of that. They're just allowing you to click through on your iTunes account and donate directly. Since they don't track addresses and stuff, all you're going to get is just acknowledgement on your credit card that the donation was made. But it's just another way that people are trying to make it easy for you to donate to help out, which is going to be a huge effort in a country that is already stone broke. But we can relate to that a little bit. So if you want to help, keep those in mind. Keep those thoughts and prayers for the people in Japan going throughout this night when we spring forward. How God changes your brain might help explain why that's actually a really good therapeutic thing for you to do, if only just to do it for yourself. But first, well, let's go over what we know about Chernobyl before we get to some open line calls, as it informs what's going on even as we speak. Just heard again an update, a meltdown has occurred. Japanese officials are saying a meltdown has occurred. To what degree that will affect the rest of the planet? How can it be contained? We'll explore that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponnet. Well, even as the Red Cross is preparing to send over American teams into Japan to help with the potential recovery of both victims and of bodies and to create at least an infrastructure to help those people who are trying to survive get by. Even as that's happening, we are getting reports that say now Japanese officials, even if they're not by name on the record, are admitting that a meltdown has occurred, but that the containment area around the meltdown, that remains intact. James Childs is the author of Inviting Disaster and a regular guest on Coast to Coast whenever something like this happens. Good evening, Jim.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for making time for us. So I understand we're catching you on the road somewhere in Georgia tonight?
Yes, and far northern Georgia.
Far northern Georgia. Well, it can't be that far. It's still Georgia. But in the beautiful mountainous area of North Georgia. Right. It's gorgeous up there. We'll get to some calls coming up here in just a minute. But you've studied these things, and you took a look at what went wrong and what went right with Chernobyl. How does that inform us at how we can look at what's happening right now with this damaged nuclear power station in Japan?
Well, there's rather limited physics in comparison between Chernobyl and the Fukushima Unit 1, and now it looks like Unit 3. Of course, that whole incident over the last couple of days is far from being finished, but I would say they have a couple of things in common, if nothing else, for the effect on public confidence. Huge hit after Chernobyl and Three Mile Island.
Well, tell me about that. So public confidence meaning?
Well, the assurances that were given, and I'll get to the boiling water reactors in just a moment. That's the kind that's at issue over in Japan, called the boiling water reactor. Very different from that at Chernobyl, which was a graphite moderated. Imagine a big pile of graphite bricks. And it was the Chernobyl was a power reactor. All of those are shut down, fortunately. They lasted until the year 2000, but they're all offline, certainly an unsafe design that the Soviets had come up with. There's one other commonality between Chernobyl and this particular incident. It may not amount to anything. It's called an unintended criticality. That is, you may have heard of that big shed that's been erected over the Chernobyl unit.
Right, exactly.
That shed, yes, hundreds of feet high and even more hundreds of feet long. That's to keep water out of the rubble. Now, the reason you may have heard about the boric acid, boron, being put into the water, that is a criticality poison. It's to stop critical nuclear reaction. And so the concern is, as those fuel elements, and it, in my mind, it's pretty clear that some of them have overheated. And when that happens, they tend to break up and turn into rubble. And that happened at Three Mile Island Unit 2. Anyway, when they begin to rearrange themselves, the fuel rods, about 100 tons probably in the Japanese reactor, then the risk is they can rearrange themselves into a critical mass. And so the idea of the boric acid being added to the seawater, what a strange combination.
Right.
Before, that's to keep it from... now, of course, we're not...
Okay, wait. I'm going to jump in and say that so the difference is we could be experiencing a meltdown, but not a critical mass.
That's right. A meltdown, I don't really like that word a whole lot. I mean, melting of the fuel rods... meltdown, what is that? You know, does that mean it comes out the bottom like in China syndrome, or what is exactly a meltdown? Any melting of the fuel assemblies is completely unacceptable. Now, whether or not it doesn't look like it's gotten out of the primary containment. And on my blog, I have a link to a diagram put together by Dave Lockbaum of the Union of Concerned Scientists, a very good description of that reactor over there in Japan. It really helped me understand where the pieces are and the pictures. I can understand the pictures a lot better.
We put the link up to your blog at coasttocoastam.com. So if you go to tonight's guests, you can click on to James Chow's name and it'll take you to his blog spot where the link there for exactly what's happening. So let's go best case scenario here. Next 24 hours, what'll happen? Best case scenario.
Well, the best case scenario is what secondary containment looks like toast. I mean, that's that picture that you've seen, you know, the steel top of that box, yeah. That cube. But that doesn't mean that the actual reactor vessel has opened up. So best case is that stays tight. And, of course, the evacuation, that's gone well. I would say the best case is that the workers themselves are not injured. That's the main population at risk. Is people who initially were exposed, probably not very high concentrations, but those who have to go in there and assess the situation, you know, they're the ones to really hope and pray for because they are in the immediate zone. Now, the kind of chemicals we're looking at are iodine-131. That has a short half-life, but you've heard about the thyroid, you know, the iodine tablets. Idea that that tends to pile up in your thyroid. And there's another one, cesium-137, that acts like potassium, and that's a much more wide-ranging, longer-lived radionuclide that you don't want out across the environment because plants take it up.
And you don't want that in your body. So that's
potassium, and you don't want, the body thinks, hey, potassium, great, but it's not. It's cesium-137. So,
well, now, what's the worst-case scenario for the next 24 hours?
Well, the worst case would be that the primary containment does not hold. I think that's unlikely, but, gosh, you know, all these incidents are a little bit outside of the range of, certainly it was outside of the range of what the boiling water reactor was supposed to do. This was a very improbable incident of this multiple failures. So I'd say the worst case would be that either Unit 1 or 3, 1 looks like it's under control, but I haven't heard that much about Unit 3.
Right.
That, I mean, they're drowned in seawater, so it's hard to imagine it really overheating. But, you know, I'm not a nuclear engineer either, so I can imagine a lot of things that probably wouldn't happen. So worst case would be that the primary containment opens up, and then you get steam and these ones that I mentioned, iodine-131. But it'd probably go out to sea. So I think the main danger is past. Now, I guess one comment I'd like to put in there on behalf of the officials is because when I studied Three Mile Island, I noticed this problem is that if the experts, the guys who really know what they're doing, if they're spending their time preparing for the press, you know, people like me, that's not a good thing. Their job is to keep that situation under control. So as a reporter, I would never want to insist, I want the top most knowledgeable guy right here in front of the cameras talking to me, because that top guy, he should be fixing this problem.
That's interesting.
This is an ongoing emergency,
right?
Not a done deal. It's not like an airplane crash, you know, it's like already done.
The very interesting point. Thank you, James. The book, The Inviting Disaster, you can find that always still selling well at Amazon. And you can find out more about James's blog on this by going to coasttocoastam.com. He will continue to track this disaster as it either unfolds or as it cools. And that we don't know at this hour. So thank you so much. We do know that some Japanese officials anonymously are saying that meltdown has occurred. At least they're calling it a partial meltdown. But if something's melting, isn't it melting? You know, I mean, if you had something very valuable, a painting, and you said it was partially melted, it's still melted. But however that's getting parsed right now, or they're looking for an optimistic way to phrase it, that's what is being said. And we'll continue to watch that throughout the show on Coast to Coast. We'll get to how God changes your brain on the way at the top of the hour. First, let's get to a couple of open line calls before we do. And thank you, everybody who's contributed to the show tonight. I know a lot of last minute things getting thrown in there. Phil is in St. George, Utah on Coast to Coast. Phil?
Hey, Ian. It's really tragic what happened to the Japanese people, but things have really been weird tonight here in St. George. In the Ivins area, I've seen a UFO tonight, and it changed from blue to white, and it's done right angle turns and all sorts of crazy things.
How about that?
If anybody else has seen it in the area, maybe they should give you a call, too.
Okay. I got a wild card line or two that's open, so if anybody else in the Utah area saw something like that, that'd be good to check in. Thank you. Very cool. It'll change your life. I know when I saw one when I was 18 years old, it changed the way I looked at the whole world. Steven is in Sausalito, California on Coast to Coast on a wild card. Steven?
Hello, Ian. It's a pleasure to chat with you. Two requests, please. Would you please consider extending the show topic for at least another hour? And two, would you please invite nuclear physicists as well as airline pilots to call in? Here's the reason why. My understanding of everything I've learned my entire lifetime about nuclear plants, of which a lot of it's been proven during Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, is once a nuclear meltdown occurs, it means that it's, from a physics standpoint, it's run away. It's beyond containment. It's beyond control. There isn't anything you can do to stop it, which means it eventually goes through the cement building and the stainless steel containment and then escapes out into the atmosphere. And once it's in the atmosphere, it goes vertical and it ends up in the jet stream, and then it goes for thousands of miles around the planet, as Chernobyl did when it contaminated the world. And people for not only hundreds but thousands of miles over the following 20 years ended up getting sick with all kinds of different cancers. And my concern is, if it gets up into the atmosphere, I believe it's already released. I believe meltdown is well in the progress, and it's just a matter of hours or a few days before it escapes out of the stainless steel containment building. If it hasn't already, it's going to end up in the jet stream. And guess what? It's going to be over to the United States.
Okay, we did talk about it earlier in the hour, so maybe that's part of the problem. You missed, we had Patrick Hammeron, who's a meteorologist who studies the jet stream all the time and says, addressed specifically to these concerns, and they're very legitimate concerns, which is why I booked him and had him address those. The good news is that the majority of what even happened in Chernobyl didn't have a devastating impact on the world, and they may have a jump on this to be able to keep it from happening. As you just heard James Childs, who's an expert on, been studying Chernobyl for years and studies disasters, this one seems to be in a very different place than Chernobyl. I hope that comes as good news to you.
Let's hope so. And by the way, you know, I just want to compliment you and Coast, as always, to producers and everybody on staff, because this is the only network that's talking about the real issues. I'm really offended by the mainstream media, where they're sugarcoating this and are not even discussing it from a physics standpoint about how threatening this is to everybody. Yeah, so I appreciate your job, and I wish everybody well. Let's hope it doesn't remain contained, but I think that's wishful thinking at this point.
It may be, but, you know, sometimes sometimes the best, just after a series of worst case scenarios happen, sometimes you can get a best case scenario to come out of it. And wouldn't that be handy right about now? We could use a seven, I think. Eric is in Lodi, California, first time caller line on Coast to Coast. Eric?
Yes, sir.
All right. You're on open lines. Go ahead.
Hey, my question is for the neurologist regarding our brains and the movie Limitless. If it is possible for one to use the full 100% of its brain, is it pretty much accurate to the movie Limitless? And why do we have such large brains if we're not going to use, you know, the whole thing?
Many of the questions I will get to coming up after the top of the hour, I promise you, since the doctor's not on yet, we'll just hang on to those questions for now. But yes, as I had promised, it's one subject I'll get to. A good movie, by the way. I don't know if I'm embargoed from talking about it. I'm not a movie reviewer, so I don't know that they can hold me back from saying good movie. Bradley Cooper and Robert De Niro comes out next weekend. The director was supposed to be on this hour, but I don't know. Something happened. I hope it was something more than just, you know, a reservation at an exclusive restaurant came available. But whatever it was, he will not be on with us. And I'm sorry that you'd heard that promoted on Coast to Coast. We'll still address the topic, though, at least in part, coming up next hour. Rod is in Conway, Arkansas on Coast to Coast. Rod?
Yeah, a longtime listener of the best show on the radio. All the stuff that's happening in the world, I mean, it's like BP, Katrina, the earthquake in New Zealand. You know, this thing, it's like, it's just like depressing, you know? It's like, how much empathy am I supposed to feel? How does this compare with World War II? You know, as far as all this stuff is hitting pretty quick now. And
I don't know that anything's happening any quicker than they ever has. I've been sort of studying disasters for years. There was a great book I grew up with called Darkest Hours. It was written by a guy named J. Robert Nash, and it was a compendium of the world's biggest disasters. And it was interesting to read that book. I bought it when I was a teenager, and it's still on my desk. And I go through it all the time, and it's fascinating to see how much worse, in many cases, disasters used to be because they didn't build buildings to withstand earthquakes, and they didn't use a lot of science in the planning of some of these communities. And so, you know, some of the devastations of past earthquakes and tsunamis have been much worse than what we have now. But
maybe it's just a faster media.
Yeah, that's it. You got it 100%. That's exactly what it is. And the images are so very powerful.
And it just piles up that much quicker.
And we can sit there and we can watch hours of coverage of it, right?
I just leave and go out and try to have a good time and get away from the tube.
I don't blame you. And we should always do this, too. Just know that, $5 does make a difference. And it doesn't have to be $50. And I understand that empathy fatigue of which you speak. And a lot of people experience that. So, you know, just if you give a little bit, if everybody gave a little bit for every one of these little disasters, 1-800-RED-CROSS or, you know, at the website or something, just $5, $10. It's enough to make your little part count, but it doesn't mean that you have to break the bank to help every time, because there will be another one. Sadly, coming up, we're just coming up to that flooding season. We saw what happened in the Northeast last week. We know Upper Midwest is going to get flooded with all of the snowpack that's here. Jan's in Brooklyn, New York. We have just a minute, I think, or even less. Jan?
Hi, Ian. Did you ever think that because you can't sleep, it has to do with electromagnetic fields? When I turn off the fuse levers in my box, it's like amazing. My whole body relaxes.
And well, also, that's a good idea.
Also, if you put a piece of wool between your pillow and your pillowcase at night, your head will get more relaxed and energized.
A piece of wool, you say?
Yeah.
Not
because
steel.
The pillow actually weakens people.
You know, there's a couple of products out there that have that where it's Cuddle You, I think is the name of the company, and they have wool stuff that goes on your mattresses and pillows, and that's always a good thing. Well, so how God changes your brain. We'll get the latest results from a very, very diligent neuroscientist. Fascinating material. We'll start with that question about Limitless, this new movie coming out next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.